introduce Christine until right now, or I would have prepared better. I guess in honor of her innocence, I'm wearing this pink tie this morning for her spiritual talk. And I've known Christine for probably 17 years. I've seen her around the country at different conventions. We've shared a common bond in young people's AA and the International Convention for Young People. And I've been to her home group in her town. She got very active in general service through Young People's and served as a delegate. How many years ago?
10.
How old were you?
30.
She was 30 when she was delegate. And I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was because that'll disclose her age. But I love Christine very much, and I'm looking forward to hearing her talk this morning.
Hi, everybody. I'm Christine, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Christine.
Hi. It's great to be here. It's great to be sober, and it's nice to be in Georgia, especially in March. Even if there is a tornado, it's a lot better. I got sober in 1987. I just celebrated 21 years of sobriety. I have a home group. It's the Dearborn Heights group that Tim has visited, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, for anybody who is not a mathematician, that makes me, I was 21 when I got sober, so that makes me 29 now. I've had a great visit so far. I was picked up from the airport by Shelley and Elnor, and I felt at home immediately. And then I met Beth and Sue. And last night I started feeling sad that I'm going to be going, but that's the way Alcoholics Anonymous is, and it's the power of our program. I can go anywhere and meet friends and feel pretty close to people in a short period of time. So thank you for your hospitality. I always am a little surprised to find myself behind a podium, and I'll tell you why. Mildred last night was talking about being locked in a cage of fear, and that phrase has stuck with me since your talk last night, and that pretty much describes me prior to Alcoholics Anonymous and sometime afterwards. But when I was growing up and going to school, high school, you know how you had to give oral reports? I was always sick on that day because of the fear. And when I went to college after graduating, college was kind of nice because the first day of school they give you a syllabus that has everything you're going to do for the whole semester. There was no surprises. So I became good at glancing through the syllabus right away and looking for any oral component to the syllabus, because if I had to give a speech, I wasn't going to take the class, period. It wasn't even negotiable. And so I would drop the class and find another one. And that's because of my fear. I was ruled by the fear that I had. Well, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and once I got serious about it, I realized that I was going to have to face my fears, and I could see that people were getting up behind podiums and that sort of thing, and I knew that sooner or later I was going to have to face it, so I took Speech 101, which was a big step for me. I was very nervous. And on the first day of school, the first day of that class, the professor had us get up, just stand up and say your name and what you were studying in school. It was no big deal, unless you've been avoiding it for 10 years or more. And so I got up, and at that point I had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous daily for 10 months. And so I was comfortable getting up and introducing myself with my name. So I stood up and I said, "Hi, I'm Christine. I'm in..." And then I stopped because I almost said, "I'm an alcoholic." But I stopped. I just said, "Hi, I'm Christine. I'm a..." And then I stopped and I said my last name, which at that point, before I was married, was Cherry. So I don't know what they thought of me. I don't remember anything beyond that point. My brain shut down. But, at least around here we learned that we can laugh at ourselves and we can overcome the things that were once obstacles. And Joe, I appreciated your talk on Friday night. I can relate to your love for Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly believe that it's the love that I've developed around here for Alcoholics Anonymous that has helped me to sustain sobriety in the good times, the bad times, or whatever. I know that when I come here, I feel better and things get better, and I'm grateful for that. And Sue gave a great talk, an Al-Anon talk yesterday, but this is the spiritual morning speaker, so I won't touch on that. I grew up locked in a cage of fear. Here's some examples. I remember being in a dentist office as a young girl, probably, I don't know, fourth grade, 10, 11, and sitting, waiting to be called on, and being thirsty. I wanted a drink of water, but the drinking fountain was across the waiting room, and I was too scared to get up and walk over because of the attention it would draw to me. I was very shy, very scared, painfully shy. And another time, I spent the night, second grade, spent the night at my friend's house, and I was very excited to do it. I didn't get to do stuff like that very much, and her mother suggested that we take a shower before we go to bed. And I didn't know, I knew how to take a shower at my house, but I had never taken a shower somewhere else, and I didn't want to be wrong about how long you should stay in the shower. I mean, it's silly to me now, but I remember standing in the shower thinking, is this long enough to be in the shower? Well, a long period of time passed. I was frozen there. And finally they came in and asked me if I was okay. They were concerned. Another time I was in third grade, so I must have been about 8, and I had to go to the bathroom. And I was too afraid to ask to go to the bathroom, and so I wet my pants right there in class, on the chair, dripping everywhere. And so the teacher was a very nice lady. She came over, and she talked to me about it, and I said, it wasn't me. I thought I could convince her. I used to lie all the time. I mean, I remember my drinking out of the milk carton, opening the refrigerator and drinking out of the milk carton. My mom was she had rules. She had standards. And so we were not allowed to drink out of the milk carton, but it was so inconvenient to get a glass all the time. So I was drinking out of the milk carton, and I heard her coming, and I put it back, milk, you know how you have the milk mustache. She said, I told you not to drink out of the milk carton. I said, I'm not. I would automatically lie, no matter what. I remember being sober, and I bought my first car sober. It was $10,000. It was a used car. I thought it was a lot of money. It was a lot of money for me. Then my brother went with me. My brother's not an alcoholic. And at that time, my mom had passed away, and my grandma was the one who I answered to. And so he and I were driving home with my new car. We were getting ready to show my grandma, and I said, now, John, when we get there, how much are we going to tell her I spent on the car? I mean, I was an adult. I was 22 years old at that time, and I just knew that $10,000 was a lot of money, and he said, Christine, why do you have to lie? And I realized it never occurred to me not to lie. I just automatically lied. Sometimes I find myself in the middle of a really great story, and then I stop and think, oh, wait, that never happened. I've been telling that lie for so long that I forget. I do come clean with that now, but I do have some embarrassing stories that really did happen. For example, one time I came home drunk. Now, my mom and dad were divorced when I was 3, and I had 2 brothers, one older and one younger. Of the four of us, I'm the only one who drank. I'm the only alcoholic of the bunch. My mom was very responsible. She was a teacher. She she really cared a lot about my education, my well-being, my success. And so she had a lot of rules and a lot of pride and that sort of thing. And I started drinking around seventh grade, and it was a relief. It was like it opened the cage doors. It took the fear away. It took the shyness away. And once I realized that, that's what I looked for the rest of my drinking days. And one time I came home drunk. It was one of those nights when you lay on the bed and everything is spinning. And so I just laid there. The next thing I know, I wake up naked in my brother's bed. And he's in there too. It was a twin bed, very small. And he's next to me. And I was petrified. I didn't know what happened. He was dressed. I wasn't. So I tiptoed back to my room, and I discovered all my clothes in a pile on the floor, and the bed was soaking wet. I peed myself and went to the driest bed. That was really embarrassing. You know, I mean, it doesn't bother me today because I'm grateful for my recovery, and I know that I don't have to live like that anymore. But I mean, and those were the early days, and it's a progressive disease. And, you know, the embarrassment of it all. He came up to me the next day, and he said, "Can I ask you a question? What were you doing in my bed last night?" I don't know if he ever realized I was naked, but I'm grateful I don't have to wake up naked with my brother anymore. I loved to drink. I loved the party life, and I loved boys. Boys were another thing that diverted my attention and got me distracted. I was really good at relationships and developing them. My first major boyfriend, my first big boyfriend was Roger. I met Roger. I met him when I came out of a blackout. And I was in the back seat of a car on New Year's Eve with about 8 other people, and we were kissing. I was on his lap. And that relationship lasted a good 10 months. That was a long time. I was in 10th grade then. And Roger got mad at me once 10 months later because I was in another blackout kissing another boy. I got drunk, and I either wet my pants or kissed a boy. As far as I know, I never did it simultaneously. So as you can imagine, Roger was very upset when he saw me kissing this other boy, and he took off. I jumped in the car. I tried to convince him that I love him. We're going to spend our life together. Please don't leave. My whole world fell apart. I put everything into other people and what they thought of me and wanting them to like me, and I was horrified at the thought of him being mad at me and that he had discovered this. And so he was mad nonetheless. He wasn't getting over it. I said, if you don't take me back, I'm going to jump out of the car. He said, go ahead. And I did. And I walked home. And that was one of the most down moments of my life. The next day, I stayed home from school because I couldn't imagine going to school and facing all the people who knew that I had done this. And my mom had some sleeping pills, and I took the whole bottle of sleeping pills, like 20 of them. It was a prescription. And I was sitting on the couch, just in a daze, you can imagine. And my back was to the window, and we had some thick, heavy drapes that were covering the windows. And as I sat there, I felt a tap on my shoulder. And I turned around, and I saw a bright light, and I knew I had to go throw up. And so I walked to the bathroom, up the stairs, probably crawling, and made myself throw up. And I believe that saved my life. And I totally forgot that entire event until well into my sobriety. God has always been with me. I've chosen not to see him, but he's always been there. The footsteps in the sand. And when I was 18, on the last day of school, I got drunk, because that's what everybody did on the last day of school, I thought. And one of the teachers could tell that I was obviously plastered, couldn't even walk. And so she sent me to the principal's office. Now, my dad was pretty much out of the picture of my life from the time I was 3 on. I mean, he would come and visit haphazardly. It was supposed to be every other weekend, but of course it wasn't. He was a practicing alcoholic. I didn't know that. I never saw him drink. But I spent many days waiting on the porch for him to pick me up, and he'd never show up. I remember going to the middle of the street and just gazing down the street looking for his car that wouldn't come. And then when he did make it, I would be so happy and spend the next day or two with him. My mom, of course, the responsible one, I was always angry at her, always mad at her. I was mad at her for being mad at him. She didn't understand. He was the hero, and she was the problem. And looking back on it, I can see how crazy that is and how much that must have hurt her. But that's the way it was. And so my last day of school, I get in trouble. Now, my mom was a teacher in the same school district, so she knew all of the administrators and all of the people, and so she was continually embarrassed by my behavior in school. But so this last time, and they would always call her. She was the parent on record. But this day, for some reason, they called my dad. And so my dad had just gotten sober. I didn't know that. They didn't know that. Well, he got the call. He came and got me. He concluded that I was an alcoholic and that I needed to go to AA, which was a bit of a jump for me, because doesn't everybody drink on the last day of school? I had actually been preparing for that moment for many years. We went to the certain park. You decorated your car for the graduation, and you drank. I was the first one there. I was well prepared. And so I thought that everybody was overreacting. My dad took me to a meeting soon afterward that week. It was an open speaker meeting, and the girl who was speaking was 18 years old. She was my age, and she had 3 years of sobriety. And I heard her talk. She talked about her story, and I felt embarrassed. That's the main feeling that I had for her. I felt embarrassed for me because I was sitting next to my dad. But I heard the message that recovery is possible. Even though at that time I didn't think that I was an alcoholic, I didn't even think I had a problem drinking. I just thought that if I had problems, they were other things. They were the fact that my mom was too strict, and that I didn't have a good enough boyfriend, or I didn't have enough money. I didn't have the right car. I had a Cutlass. I wanted a Mustang, that sort of thing. And so I was always looking outside of myself as what the problem was. Well, my dad persisted. He took me to meeting after meeting after meeting, and they were all open talks. I could sit there and just listen to the message. And from day one, I appreciated Alcoholics Anonymous and the people there. I thought it was great that everybody at Alcoholics Anonymous was doing something about their problem. It took about a year for me to get to the point where I thought, if I ever had a problem, I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous myself. I was in a lot of denial. My dad would take me to the meetings, and then we would go out to a restaurant afterwards, and they have those paper placemats. He would flip it over. He'd start drawing, and he'd draw all of the symptoms of alcoholism and try to get me to circle the ones that I could relate to. Oh, it's horrible. And he'd draw the Jelinek chart, the progression of the disease of alcoholism, and he'd have me pinpoint where I was on the chart. And, of course, I was right at the beginning. But it was okay, you know. And finally, and I wasn't very good at speaking my mind. I've gotten a lot better at that. But to say to my dad, "Dad, I don't want to go," it was too scary. So I just kept going, which probably was good for me back then. But he could tell that, you know, that I wasn't really getting involved the way he wanted me to. He said, and there were a number of young people around who were going to the meetings, and one time he pointed out to me a group of people, young people my age or a little older, and he said, Christine, they're going to Cedar Point to where they ride roller coasters and stuff. He said, you should go with them because it's a whole group of young people. And I said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea, knowing that I would never put my name on a list to go to Cedar Point with a bunch of people who don't drink. It didn't make sense. Why would I want to do that? Not that I had a problem with drinking, but why would I do that? I did not see that I had a problem, but I knew that I wouldn't have fun if I wasn't drinking. And he wanted me to go to picnics and get involved with these different people, and I just, it did not appeal to me at all. And I got to the point where finally I mustered up enough courage, probably a year or two later, and I said, Dad, I don't want to go anymore. And he said, okay. And he bought me a book, The Courage to Change, and it's a book about different people who suffer from alcoholism. And on the inside cover he wrote, I, Christine Cherry, make the following choice: to ask for help, and there was a little box to check, and the other choice was do it on my own. Well, that was a no-brainer. I happily said, I'll do it on my own, checked that box, and I was off the hook, so I thought. A few other things happened. You know, the disease is progressive. I ended up, ended up in places that were dangerous. I was at a house once, and the house was robbed. People came in with guns. They were stealing all of the money. It was a house that sold drugs, so they were stealing the money and the drugs. And they made us all, it was my boyfriend at the time's house. His parents sold drugs. To me, it was a perfect relationship. but these people barged in. They didn't have, you know, we could identify them. My opinion was, there's no way I'm going to live through this because I can identify who they were. They shot the gun into the floor to get our attention. They didn't need to do that. They had our attention. And they made us lay down on the living room floor on our stomachs. And those moments lasted a very long time. In the entire time, I thought about my mother and how was she going to hear the news that her daughter was killed in a drug house, and the regret that I had for the relationship I had with her and not living up to her expectations, the things that I knew I could be, the things I knew I could do. But obviously they didn't shoot us. They left the house. And then those moments were gone, and I continued to do what I did. Not long after that, I was with a couple friends. My boyfriend was one of them. And we were dropping a friend off, and someone walked up to the car and wanted to rob us. And he had a ski mask on, and he was banging the gun on the car door. And we didn't open the door, and he shot a gun. And it went through my boyfriend's neck and killed him instantly, I believe. And he took off. And I don't know if he was killed instantly or not, but I mean, obviously that was a hard thing to deal with. I never dealt with anything traumatic, and I got out of the car. I ended up, they kind of kept us in a house for the rest of the night and told us not to talk to anybody until the detectives got there. It took the detectives 5 hours to get there. And so those were long moments. And again, I thought about my mom, my life, the things that have happened. I've thought about my boyfriend. He was 19. I had just turned 20. And my family was very concerned, as you can imagine. So was everybody else. And in the months that followed that, I pushed everybody away. I didn't want to talk about it. I just wanted people to leave me alone. It was like the box I checked in the book. I can do it on my own. Just leave me alone. I just need time. Give me space. I ended up spending a lot of time at one particular friend's house, and my dad continued to try to get my attention. He wanted to take me to meetings. He wanted My mom, she didn't know what to do. She had no idea I was an alcoholic. She was in her own denial. She tried everything she could do. This is the time in my life where I really needed to drink to kind of deal with stuff, but you know how alcohol is. Now when I used to drink for fun. Now I was drinking for relief, and it wasn't working. The more I drank, the more depressed I got. If I didn't drink, I needed to drink. And in the meantime, my dad kept trying to take me to meetings, and he'd take me to some closed meetings. But I resisted it all. So my dad, now he had been taking me to meetings for a couple years, about two years, and he gave me an ultimatum. He said, listen, Christine, I know you don't like going to meetings, and I'm going to give you an option. You can either, he was really good at ultimatum. He said, you can either, no, it was a deal. He said, if you go to see a therapist for one session with me, then I'll never bug you about your drinking again. Now, that's a good deal. And I said, okay, I'll do that. That was August 5th of 1986. So we go. I was living with my grandmother at the time, and we leave the house, and I say, bye, Grandma, and we drive over to the therapist's house or office, and I expect a small little office with a plant and a table and a couple chairs and a therapist. And I walk into the room, and it was a big room, and it was a circle of chairs, and it was full of people who were close to me. My mom was there, both of my brothers, my person I worked for, some of my friends, my dad, my grandma, my little old grandma, who I just left. I don't know how she got there. And so it was an intervention, and they went around, and they talked about my drinking. They had been setting me up for several months, unbeknownst to me. I wasn't working. I had quit my job by this time. I had crashed my car, so I was in bad shape financially. And they would leave money out or make it easy for me to. I stole money all the time from my family. And so, you know, I would take it. But they were recording all the time, you know. February 10th, there was $20 taken out of Grandma's wallet, and so they had data. So it was hard to argue that. I couldn't argue it. It was a very tough time because it was like revealing me. It was taking all the masks off. It was very uncomfortable. I always pretended to be who I thought you wanted to be. I had no idea who I was. And to sit in that room with all these different factions together, obviously they had spoken. I mean, my friends, my girlfriends knew things about me that my mom should never know. Even my mom and dad, I never saw them talk, have a conversation. And so it was just very uncomfortable. And they said, we need you to go to treatment. And if you do that, we will never bug you about your drinking again. I wasn't really believing them by this time, but but I didn't have a choice. I wouldn't have anywhere to live if I didn't go. They said it's a 28-day program. I went in. I was 20 at the time. The next youngest person was 32 years old, which was really old back then. And her name was Carol. She was a motorcycle kind of gal. Her and I became very close friends, it turns out. But I spent the first 3 days of treatment in my room as much as possible. And I remember looking out my door at the people walking past in the hallway, the other inmates there, and thinking what a big mistake it was that I ended up here. I'm just a sweet, innocent, young, I mean, everybody drinks like I do. All my friends do. I don't have a problem. If they had gone through what I had gone through and had the difficulties in their life that I have in my life, they would have drank too. It's the other things that are my problem. It's not the drinking. In fact, drinking was the only thing that I looked forward to. And the thought of taking that away didn't make sense to me, because then what would I be left with? And that was a scary thought. And they didn't allow me to stay in my room, and I had to come out. And I tell you, miracles happen in those 28 days. Celebrate the miracle. By the time I left 28 days later, I had made friendships with people who were not like me. They were all of all different types. And I realized, not that I was an alcoholic, but I realized that, and this was a big change for me, I realized that everything I did revolved around drinking. Every decision I made revolved around drinking. I did not want to do it if I couldn't drink while I was doing it. That doesn't mean I didn't do things without drinking being part of it. Sometimes you just have to endure. But I wasn't happy about it unless I could drink. And so I got out of treatment, and I had a little bit of a desire to stay sober. You know, not 100% for sure. I started going to meetings, and they gave the old go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was good at setting goals, so I said, okay, I can do that. And I wrote down the meetings on my calendar. I put a little smiley face every time I went to a meeting. And I hung out with Carol, the biker. I call her Carol Baby. And we would go to meetings all the time. And after 90 days of going to meetings, my dad was very happy. My mom was very happy. And they took me out to celebrate. We went to this really fancy restaurant, and my mom and dad never got along before. Now they're talking. They're taking me out to dinner together. My dad gives me a $100 bill. My mom gives me a $100 bill. They shower me with gifts and gratitude and love. I just did 90 meetings in 90 days. I'm feeling good. I celebrated. So I got drunk the next day. And it's not to say that 90 meetings in 90 days doesn't work, but there's more to it than that. And I had set it as a goal for me to do it. And the other thing is that I knew I was going to drink. I had thoughts of drinking for weeks and weeks prior to picking up the drink. I was coming up on my 21st birthday. You know, that was a shame that I couldn't drink on my 21st birthday. I don't know why. But I had my fair share of drinking before that, but for some reason it was a big deal to me. And I had a lot of doubts, you know. I mean, I didn't know about being an alcoholic. I knew that, you know, I started to see that I drank a lot. And once I started drinking, I didn't want to stop. I knew that. I could see that it had caused problems in my life. In fact, I got fired from my first job for drinking. I was 14. And the boss was away, and we brought some drinks in, and he showed up, and so I got fired. So it definitely affected my life. But to go as far as saying I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink, that I wasn't sure. I had a lot of doubts. I thought maybe it's a phase I'm going through. Maybe. And so if I had had a sponsor, perhaps I could have shared it with her. Or even if I hadn't gone as far as getting a sponsor, if I had talked about it with anybody, it probably would have helped. But I didn't. I just kept it all in. I was not good at being honest. I wasn't good at sharing. I was scared. I was still locked in a cage of fear. And so I drank. And I went to meetings. And I didn't tell anybody. By this time, I had developed a lot of friendships in the program. Carol Baby would always call me up. We'd go to meetings together. But I was drinking on the side. And so finally, I ended up going to a meeting drunk, and it was pretty obvious. So people knew that way. And I drank for about 2 or 3 months. And it was different. You know, they say AA will ruin your drinking, and it did for me. I knew then that I didn't have to drink. I knew then that there was a world of recovery that I never had seen before. And I also had developed a lot of close friendships within the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day I found myself drinking in an apartment with some married guy. It was just he and I in their dirty little apartment. I felt horrible about myself. I felt shameful for being there. But I wouldn't have been anywhere else because that's where I was drinking that day. And I was getting ready to leave, and I glanced out the window of the apartment we were in, and there was a church across the street, and that church is my home group today, and I had been to that meeting before. And at the moment I looked out the window, the meeting was letting out. It's a pretty big meeting. There were a couple hundred people coming out of the meeting, and I was standing in the window looking at them, and I knew they were leaving from an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I had been to. I knew a lot of the people that were there, and I knew that I didn't have to live the way that I was living anymore. And for me, that was a spiritual moment that changed my life. And it was a couple weeks after that I got the call from Carol Baby, and she said, "Christine, are you going to go to the meeting?" And I said, "Yeah." And we went to the meeting. And I've been going to the meetings ever since. And I'm so grateful that I have been given back my life. And Mildred said yesterday, "I believe that everything that I have in my life is a result of my involvement with Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I have is a gift. It doesn't belong to me. I came in, I was scared, and I was shy. And someone asked me once, or told me once, just be yourself, Christine." I guess they could tell I was having a hard time with that. And I had the thought, who's that? I didn't know who I was when I got here. I didn't know, because I spent so long being who you wanted me to be. And so I just kind of trudged along. I knew that I needed to get a sponsor, but I had a lot of requirements for a sponsor, and so for a while I just went to meetings, and I ended up going to that meeting, which is my home group, Dearborn Heights, and at that time I really wasn't too fond of it because I thought it was cliquey. And I went to the meeting, and we had what we used to lovingly call grouchy old-timers. And there was this one guy, Bill, who was there, and he kind of took me under his wing. I went there. I didn't want to stay for the meeting. I was just dropping off flyers for some event I was involved with. And he said, "Oh, no, you need to stay for the meeting." And so I did. And we sat down at a table, and he was sharing. And it was the first time I remember being at a meeting where I was totally honest about how I felt. And I said, "You know, I don't feel comfortable here. I don't feel like I fit in. I don't want to come to this particular meeting because it feels clicky." And he said, "What you need to do is make coffee." And so and so I did. I started making coffee. We met twice a week. We still do. And that was my first commitment in AA, is making coffee at that meeting. And that was a blessing. I made coffee. I met people. It was probably within a week where it wasn't a click anymore and it wasn't an uncomfortable meeting, because I started to meet the people and become friends with them. And he used to tell me, "Christine, I've seen your type. You come around here, you get all involved in everything." Because I did. You know, once I came back, I was involved. I went to meetings all the time. I did as much as I could. I signed up for whatever I could. I got involved with the young people stuff. I made announcements at meetings. He said, "I've seen your type. You come around here, you get all involved. After a year, we're not going to see you anymore." And that bothered me, because I was going to show Bill. So I kept coming around, and when I did reach a year of sobriety, I was very proud, but the main thing on my mind was to let him know that I got a year, and he was wrong. And so I went up to him, I said, "Bill, I've got a year." And, you know, you'd expect him to say, "Great job, congratulations." He said, "You'll never make two." But I took to him. He's got a reputation, or he had one. He's passed away now, but he had a reputation. He was very tough on a lot of people. But him and I became really close friends, and he helped me a lot. And I wanted my mom to meet him. And he was celebrating 21 years of sobriety or something like that. So I took her to that meeting. It was an open meeting. And I thought she would leave being very grateful for, you know, that the people I know and that sort of thing. Because she spent most of her life telling me, "You're hanging around with the wrong crowd." And I was with a lovely crowd of alcoholics. But when we left the meeting, I said, "So what did you think?" And she had this shocked look on her face. And she said, are you going to have to go to meetings for 21 years? She was horrified. You know, she was kind of sad. She's not an alcoholic. She had lost her daughter to alcoholism, and she wanted her daughter back. And now I was immersed in AA. And I was immersed in AA, but I was back to where I was getting back. And alcoholism tears apart families. Alcoholics Anonymous brings them back together. My home group, we have a large Al-Anon population and involvement. And one of the things that I really like about that is because we get to see families recover together. And there's no greater gift than seeing that. And my mom got sick when I was 5 months sober. She was 48 years old, and she developed cancer, and she died about 3 weeks later. And that was in 1987, so it's been a while. But it was a tough time. I didn't have a sponsor yet, or I had just gotten a sponsor right before that had happened. I didn't develop a relationship with her. But I had the group. You know, I had been going to that group for several months making coffee. You know, God has always been present in my life, and I never saw that he was there. The people from that group carried me through that time. When we went to the funeral home, the rest of my family was shocked at who are all these people. And there were more AA members there than I had family, and they were there to support me. And that was very powerful. You know, I knew that I had to keep doing this in AA. I knew that I did not want to go back to the girl in the window looking out wishing that I had what you had. And so I kept plugging along. I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I did a lot of things wrong. I had a lot of the wrong motives some of the time. But little by little, the process of recovery in AA chipped away at my defects and allowed me to come out. And that's exactly what I did. I started to realize that I needed to develop a relationship with God. And by the time I came to AA, I had turned away from God and decided that God was not for me. I was an intellectual. I thought, you know, I was of the science mind. I was the belligerent one. And I actually, the first step for me as far as developing a relationship with God is I got a scrapbook, and I started collecting things that would be my higher power if I were to create it myself. So when I was looking through magazines, if I saw a picture or a saying that reminded me of what would God be, I would cut it out, and I created this page, a collage of my higher power. And a lot of those things that I picked out and drew on that paper are what I think of as my higher power today. And it was, you know, one was a picture of eyes. I believe that I can see God in people's eyes. God works through people. That's one of the things you taught me. And I know that that's true. I mean, it's amazing to me how many times I come to a meeting with a particular concern, whether I'm aware of it or not, and the person sitting next to me stands up and shares about it, exactly what I need to hear, right when I need to hear it. That's spirituality to me. And the feeling that I get when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that just washes down over me, I never felt that anywhere else but here. And that's spirituality to me. Sometimes when we're saying the Lord's Prayer, the Serenity Prayer, and we're holding hands, and I get that feeling that comes down over me. I've never experienced that anywhere else. Or listening to a person share and being touched by their story. The fact that I can get out of myself enough to care about other people. That's spirituality to me. And those are all blessings. I was 5 years sober. You know, honesty has always been, I love our coins that say, to thine own self be true. And I cherish that and I believe it. There were a lot of times when I was at that point where I wanted to drink and I thought, who would know? And that's the phrase that popped up. To thine own self be true. I would know. And that carried me through. So I was 5 years sober and in a lot of pain because I was pretty much still locked in the cage. Recovery is a process, and I had a lot of problems. I had a lot of financial problems at that point in my life. My mom had died. I inherited a little money. I was very irresponsible. I blew it all. I was very generous to my friends. That's a good person to know then. But then they started sending the credit cards and blah, blah, blah. I was in a lot of trouble. And so I went to a meeting one day knowing that it was time that I come clean with this. I had to. My life depended on it. I knew it. And when I got to the meeting, it was a very small meeting. There was a girl there who was 14. It was her first meeting ever. And I thought, oh, geez, how am I going to be honest now? Because we have a newcomer in the house, and I have to offer hope, and that's the last thing that I felt. And I made a decision to be honest anyway. And I felt like it was I was sacrificing her. I thought I had a lot of power back then. but I did. I shared, what was going on and the pain that I was in. It was one of the lowest points in my life. And I left that meeting. A couple weeks later, I got a letter in the mail. I never spoke to the girl one-on-one. But she managed to find my address, and she wrote me a letter. And she thanked me for sharing what I shared. And she said that it gave her hope. And to me, that's when I knew that God is truly in charge. I really don't have to think about it because I can't get it right. What I think I'm sharing is going to demolish hope, but in fact, it gives hope. God knows what people need to hear. My job is to show up and to be honest, because if I'm honest, the heart touches the heart, and that's when God is there. And that's what I believe today. We are blessed to have this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be a part of it. And I'm forever grateful for the people I know and the friendships that I have. Mildred and I met in 2000 in Minneapolis. We spoke together at the international convention. And we were behind the stage during when the flag ceremony was going on. And if you haven't been to an international convention, on Friday night they have a glorious ceremony where every country that has Alcoholics Anonymous is represented and they carry in the flag. There's just dozens of different countries represented. And we were backstage, so we didn't get to see any of that particular flag ceremony. But and we were pretty, there weren't many people back there, and I heard somebody crying. And I walked over, and there was this lady who I didn't know. She was sobbing, just sobbing. And I was thinking, do I walk away? Do I say something? You don't want to intrude on someone when they're feeling bad. But I stopped, and I sat down next to her, and I asked her if she was okay. And she said, I work for the UN. She was the one that was arranging the flag ceremony and getting all of the people together. And she said, we work every day at the United Nations to bring this kind of peace and harmony to the world, and you guys do it here in Alcoholics Anonymous every day. And we do, and we're blessed. I mean, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous take us above where we were and bring us all together. We're very blessed. And I'm grateful. Thank you again for inviting me to your town, to your tornado. And I'll be going back to the snow today, so I appreciate it very much. Thank you.